me. The participants included representatives of different monotheistic faiths as well as scholars and researchers who unanimously denounced the acts of desecration in Sweden as a violation of human rights and the right to freedom of thought, belief, and religion.
The Quran burning incident in Sweden is completely unacceptable. However, we should not forget that without a government support, this would not have happened. They claim to be supporting the right of freedom of expression, but let's not forget that freedom can never be absolute. There are always boundaries, and you are free to do what you want, only if it does not undermine other people's freedom.
This was not just a desecration of the holy book of Muslims. In the Holy Quran, the name of God has been repeated many times. The God that we too believe in, as well as the name of our prophet Moses. Burning silk is simply barbaric. If you disagree with an ideology or a religious belief, you should state your thoughts and your logic and discuss with the scholars. Such acts show the person who did it and those who supported his actions are incapable of doing so.
I believe that a panel discussion just like the one we had today has to be held on an international level. It is essential for people worldwide to share their opinion because such acts of blasphemy are carried out because of ignorance. Also, we have to adhere to moral values no matter what we believe in. And any person in their right mind agrees that it is against all moral standards to insult other people and their beliefs.
That is why all the participants say the recent acts of blasphemy have brought the true colors of countries that claim to be advocates of human rights to light.
Back in July, and after the Quran burning incidents in Sweden, a deeply divided UN Human Rights Council passed a controversial resolution urging countries to address, prevent, and prosecute acts of religious hatred. The resolution was passed with 28 countries voting for, 12 countries voting against, and 7 abstaining. Interestingly enough, the U.S. and the EU strongly opposed this resolution, proving once again that concepts such as human rights and freedom of expression are merely political tools at the hands of these countries. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
From Hollywood to hotel workers to Teamsters to manufacturing and elsewhere, there are so many labor actions in the United States, the mainstream media is calling it a hot labor summer. The problem isn't record heat, but low wages, poor working conditions, out-of-reach interest rates, and shocking levels of inequality amid the revocation of coronavirus-era social programs and unregulated profit hoarding by corporations. In Chicago, healthcare workers were striking for better wages and conditions amid record inflation and years of overwork.
Our members talk about all the time, does administration know how much the cost of a gallon of milk is, how much the cost of a dozen of eggs, you know, really is when you go to the store? It's just not adding up for them. They're having to pull double shifts, which is, you know, 12 to 16 hour shifts in order to be able to pay their bills.
In the largest mass layoff event since 2020, 30,000 workers and their households are now out of a paycheck after shipping giant Yellow declared bankruptcy on the eve of a labor strike. The administration of Joe Biden refused Yellow a bailout of around $1 billion, although he spent $23 billion to save two banks earlier this year and sends over $1 billion per week to fuel the unrest in Ukraine. Yellow employees registered their disgust.
We were going to go out on strike. We give them another 30 days to try to get their stuff together. And they forfeited. Of course, they tried trying to sue the union, which is a joke. Shame on them. They got to lay their head down on the pillow at night, what they squandered all this money away.
Corporate bankruptcies have hit their highest first half levels since 2010. And many say forcing a recession to bring down inflation is the true goal of the federal interest rate hikes, despite the damage it's already having on the average worker's household and the economy.
We understand that it's not just hospital workers, but it's a wave throughout the country in regards to a small group of people having the power and making these decisions to really not benefit the majority, but the small minority of individuals that are not having the troubles our members are paying their bills.
Widespread strikes in the United States? That's something many Americans have never seen, And certainly their mainstream media isn't spending much time talking about the labor uprisings. But the post-corona landscape is being defined by economic difficulty and social unrest. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. For the third time in 4 months, former United States President Donald Trump has been indicted. But this time, it's over his role in the controversial events in Washington on January 6, 2020. Trump pled not guilty to 4 counts of engaging in a criminal conspiracy to subvert the 2020 vote results and obstruction.
When you look at what's happening, this is a persecution of a political opponent. This was never supposed to happen in America. This is the persecution of the person that's leading by very, very substantial numbers in the Republican primary and leading Biden by a lot. So if you can't beat him, you persecute him or you prosecute him.
Most presidential vote polls show the race is too close to call. The ruling Democratic Party has put the United States in a historically unprecedented and potentially explosive situation. Polls show a nation evenly split on if Trump did anything illegal on January 6th and if it is time to move on from the events that day. Trump's approval rating is up 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down. Many Republicans have said that the long-delayed indictments for Trump, a sweetheart plea agreement for Biden's son, and the FBI's admitted collusion with social media companies to censor reporting which could have negatively impacted Biden in 2020 is proof of political bias in the nation's judicial system. Trump's defense is likely to include that he acted on the advice of well-regarded legal counsel, which may make it difficult to show criminal intent, and that he honestly believed the vote was not legal. A new poll shows that 70% of Republicans also believe that Biden's 2020 win was illegitimate. Multiple court cases against Trump, an increasingly likely impeachment trial in Congress for Joe Biden, ongoing corruption allegations against Joe's son Hunter Biden. The 2024 presidential campaign is shaping up to be even more divisive and full of mudslinging than in 2020. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It has been 4 years since India removed the semi-autonomous status of the Indian administered portion of the Muslim-majority region of Jammu and Kashmir. But here, anger still rages. Hundreds of Pakistanis took to the streets across the country to mark this year's 5th August, the 4th anniversary of the New Delhi's decision to abolish the autonomy of the region by including it in the Indian Federation. In 2019, India scrapped the semi-autonomous status of the disputed region, a controversial move that prompted Islamabad to cut its diplomatic ties and halt trade with New Delhi. The protesters demanded the Indian government to end what they call illegal occupation of Kashmir, accusing it of grave human rights violations that are constantly being unearthed.
If this deliberate determination is granted to the people of Jammu and Kashmir, the matter will be decided once for all. And if this matter is decided, the South Asia will be peaceful. There will be no nuclear war and there will be no conflict.
People also demanded the UN to implement a decades-old resolution that called for a referendum on whether Kashmiris wanted to merge with Pakistan or India.
We want to convey our message that we Kashmiri want our basic and fundamental right that was promised by United Nations and other organizations.
Besides rallies, conferences and seminars were also held in major cities and towns to denounce human rights violations in Jammu and Kashmir.
Whoever they are at the helm of affairs, that they should come forward and they should intervene. They should try to mitigate the human rights violations.
Kashmir, a Muslim-majority Himalayan region, is divided between India and Pakistan, and both claim it in full. The Kashmir dispute also led to several wars between the two nuclear-armed Asian rivals since they were separated back in 1947.
Pakistanis keep saying that they will continue to lend moral, diplomatic, and political support to the just cause of Kashmir. They have also called on neighboring India to honor its commitments to the Kashmiri people regarding the right to self-determination. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Leaving Lebanon's economy with an almost total economic meltdown, Riyad Salehi has stepped down as the governor of the central bank. The central bank's newly appointed acting governor, Wasim Mansouri, on Monday called on the government to implement a capital control law, a financial restructuring law, and a 2023 state budget within 6 months.
We were able to convince the government that the subsidies policy needs to stop, and as a result, management improved, and the economy relatively began to recover. However, the government's need for the U.S. dollar continues, since the only way to end the government's reliance on the central bank was to improve public finances. The problem is not monetary, and the solution is not with the central bank. The main issue is in the financial policies of the state, and there needs to be a clear decision to improve general management.
He stressed that the bank would impose restrictions on when to lend money to the government. Salehi was for years credited for economic recovery following Lebanon's civil war, yet now he is being investigated by at least 7 countries, including Lebanon, for embezzlement and illicit enrichment. He denies the accusations. A former advisor to 3 central bank governors in Lebanon tells Press TV that Salehi was merely following the U.S. policies.
He was implementing the U.S. policies, and U.S. policies since the end of World War II stipulated that the countries of the Third World are prohibited from development. They only allowed Korea and Taiwan to prosper since they want to confront China and Russia, but they also supported Israel in this region and even prevented Egypt from becoming an industrial nation.
The problem, he believes, is a problem of mismanagement as well as in the structure of the policies, which bound the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar.
He pegged the price of the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar, saying that this would stabilize the lira, but this was a catastrophic mistake, which I had warned against. The U.S. dollar itself is not stable, so pegging the lira to the U.S. dollar won't make it stable. We needed to peg our currency to a basket of currencies based on imports to Lebanon. This impacted Lebanon's ability to compete in the global markets.
The current financial crisis began in 2019 when the value of the Lebanese lira plummeted and inflation soared in the Arab country. After 30 years in his post, Lebanon's former central bank governor is seen by many experts as being the main orchestrator of the financial and monetary policies, which led to an abrupt collapse. However, there are also speculations that he couldn't have done it without collaboration from the country's political elite. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Arab woman who took on 2 far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the 2 men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Speaking to Press TV, Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out, and then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. but I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay, so it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Quds now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
Despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident, which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago, that doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defense of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
For the first time, America is set to put on trial a former president in one of the most consequential criminal cases in the country's legal history. Ex-President Donald Trump has faced criminal charges for a third time in 4 months.
Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with conspiring to defraud the United States, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and conspiring and attempting to obstruct an official proceeding.
The indictment pertains to Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat to incumbent President Joe Biden. It focuses on his actions in the two-month period between his loss to Biden and the infamous riot in Washington, D.C. During this period, Trump vehemently denied the election results, repeatedly asserting that the votes had been stolen.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
According to the indictment, Trump knowingly propagated false fraud claims and exerted pressure on state and federal officials, including Vice President Mike Pence, to manipulate the election results. When failed, Trump directed his supporters to stop certifying Biden's win. That turned into a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, leading to 5 deaths, a move that is described as an attack on America's democracy.
The attack on our nation's capital on January 6, 2021, was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy.
Trump vehemently dismisses the case as ridiculous and maintains his innocence, refuting any allegations of wrongdoing. He even goes further to accuse the prosecutors of being politically motivated, claiming they are acting on behalf of Biden to meddle in the forthcoming presidential elections, in which Trump and Biden could face off again. The two are currently tied in polls. The Trump campaign has also asserted that the Tuesday indictment amounts to election interference. Nonetheless, this is not the only obstacle standing in the way of Trump's return to presidency. The Republican politician has already been charged in 2 other cases, mishandling classified files and falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film actress, the charges that have significantly hit the former president's reputation among many Americans.
I hope he goes to prison for a long time. I think he deserves to go to prison for a long, for all the crimes he committed.
Donald Trump is now due to appear in a Washington, D.C. court on Thursday. He faces 78 criminal counts overall. These charges mean the ex-president will have 3 criminal trials to attend in the next 12 to 18 months, complicating his second run for the White House.
In the Limelight.
In the United States, maternal death rates have consistently been the highest among black women, and those high rates more than doubled over the last 20 years. For Native Americans and Alaska Native people, the maternity death rates have tripled. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Maternal death rates across the United States more than doubled over the course of two decades, and the tragedy unfolded unequally. Black mothers died at the nation's highest rates, while the largest increases in deaths were found in American Indian and Native Alaskan mothers, and some states and racial or ethnic groups within them fared worse than others. The findings were laid out in a new study published on Monday, 3rd of July, in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Researchers looked at maternal deaths between 1999 and 2019, but not the pandemic spike, for every state and five racial and ethnic groups. Dr. Allison Bryant, one of the study's authors and a senior medical director for health equity at Mass General Brigham Hospital, said, "It's a call to action to all of us to understand the root causes, to understand that some of it is about healthcare and access to healthcare, but a lot of it is about structural racism and the policies and procedures and things that we have in place that may keep people from being healthy." Among wealthy nations, the United States has the highest rate of maternal mortality, which is defined as a death during pregnancy or up to a year afterward. Common causes include excessive bleeding, infection, heart disease, suicide, and drug overdose. Dr. Allison Bryant and her colleagues at Mass General Brigham Hospital and the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington started with national vital statistics data on deaths and live births. They then used the modeling process to estimate maternal mortality out of every 100,000 live births. Overall, they found rampant widening disparities. The study showed high rates of maternal mortality aren't confined to the South, but also extend to regions like the Midwest and states such as Wyoming and Montana, which had high rates for multiple racial and ethnic groups in 2019. Researchers also found dramatic jumps when they compared maternal mortality in the first decade of the study to the second decade, and identified the five states with the largest increases between those decades. Those increases exceeded 162% for American Indian and Alaska Native mothers in Florida, Illinois, Kansas, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin, 135% for white mothers in Georgia, Indiana, Louisiana, Missouri, and Tennessee, 105% for Hispanic mothers in Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota, and Tennessee, 93% for black mothers in Arkansas, Georgia, Louisiana, New Jersey, and Texas, 83% for Asian and Pacific Islander mothers in Georgia, Illinois, Kansas, Michigan, and Missouri. Dr. Karen Joint Maddox, a health services and policy researcher at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, who wasn't involved in the study, said, "I hate to say it, but I was not surprised by the findings. We've certainly seen enough anecdotal evidence in a single state or a group of states to suggest that maternal mortality is rising." She added, "It's certainly alarming and just more evidence we have got to figure out what's going on and try to find ways to do something about this." Dr. Karen Joint Maddox pointed to how, compared with other wealthy nations, the United States underinvests in things like social services, primary health care, and mental health. She also said Missouri hasn't funded public health adequately and during the years of the study hadn't expanded Medicaid. They've since expanded Medicaid and lawmakers passed a bill giving new mothers a full year of Medicaid health coverage. Recently, the governor of Missouri, Mike Parson, signed budget bills that included $4.4 million for a maternal mortality prevention plan. According to a 2021 state report in neighboring Arkansas, black women are twice as likely to have pregnancy-associated deaths as white women. Dr. William Greenfield, the medical director for family health at the Arkansas Department of Health, said the disparity is significant and has persisted over time, and that it's hard to pinpoint exactly why there was an increase in the state's maternal mortality rate for black mothers. The website of National Public Radio, NPR, has also covered the same story and tells us more. Death rates among black women have long been the worst in the United States, and the problem affects people of all socioeconomic backgrounds. For example, U.S. Olympic champion sprinter Tori Bowie, a 32-year-old, died from complications of childbirth in May. Dr. Allison Bryant, a senior medical director for health equity at Mass General Brigham Hospital, said, "The coronavirus pandemic likely exacerbated all of the demographic and geographic trends, and that's absolutely an era for future study." According to preliminary federal data, maternal mortality fell in 2022 after rising to a six-decade high in 2021, a spike experts attributed mainly to COVID-19. Officials said the final 2022 rate is on track to get close to the pre-pandemic level, which was still the highest in decades. Dr. Allison Bryant said it's crucial to understand more about these disparities to help focus on community-based solutions and understand what resources are needed to tackle the problem. Dr. William Greenfield, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Arkansas Medical Center in Little Rock, Arkansas, said, "Arkansas already is using telemedicine and is working on several other ways to increase access to healthcare. The state also has a perinatal quality collaborative, a network to help healthcare providers understand best practices for things like reducing cesarean sections, managing complications with hypertensive disorders, and curbing injuries or severe complications related to childbirth." Dr. William Greenfield said, "Most of the deaths were reviewed and other places have reviewed were preventable. Most maternal deaths are deemed preventable by state review committees." Dr. Catherine Sponge at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center says pregnancy-related deaths can be caused by different things. She says the biggest risk factors are conditions like cardiovascular disease, severe preeclampsia, maternal cardiac disease, and hemorrhage.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. Thank you.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, for the second time in U.S. history, rating agency Fitch downgraded the U.S.'s top credit rating from AAA to AA. Fitch has cited fiscal deterioration, which basically means that the country's expenses outweighs its revenue. Now, this isn't anything new for the United States. Meanwhile, though, Moody's has cut the ratings of 10 banks by one notch, and six huge banks have been warned by the agencies that they are under review for potential downgrade. This follows the collapse of several U.S. banks earlier this year. Is this house of cards in Washington collapsing or not? Well, I'm going to introduce my guest this hour who's going to help me look at all of this. William K. Black, a white-collar criminologist, professor of economics and law, University of Missouri, Kansas City, author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. And John Edmonds, professor of finance, Babson College, Wesley, Massachusetts. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start it off in Kansas City. And William, well, the White House has tried to downplay this lower rating by Fitch and actually express basically being surprised. Your take on this, what do you think about Fitch's downgrading the U.S.? Was it apropos? Okay, I think I'm having some technical difficulties. I think I might have lost one of our guests out of Kansas City. William Black, are you there? Well, hopefully we will try to reestablish that connection. And right now it seems that I have actually lost both of my guests, having no connection with either one. We'll try to establish that. So the question at hand tonight and what we're trying to look at, of course, is the significance of this downgrading by Fitch and also by Moody's. What does it really mean in the whole scheme of things in dealing with the U.S.'s economy? And hopefully I will be joined by my guest who will help me look at that. There's a lot of back and forth with various perspectives, some saying that it actually doesn't mean a whole lot because before the U.S. has had that happen one time before, and it really wasn't that significant. But the question is really, is it significant or not? And hopefully that's what we will be looking at with our guests tonight. Well, hopefully we have reestablished both connections. That was very interesting, losing both guests at the same time. Well, William, let me just readdress that question again. Because looking at the situation, the White House has tried to downplay this lower rating by Fitch, basically expressing surprise. Let's talk about if this downgrading is significant and why would the government then, our officials, act in the way they do if it is significant?
So it really isn't very significant. It probably will leave U.S. bond rates unaffected, just as the prior downgrade a number of years ago had essentially no effect on the markets. What Moody's and others are probably trying to do is warn Congress to stop messing with the debt ceiling and threatening defaults, because that, not economics, but politics, is the threat in terms of that aspect.
Okay. Well, John, do you agree? Do you basically think that, like William, this is really not so significant?
Well, it is as a signal, but in terms of the effect that it would have on the prices of U.S. Treasury bonds at this moment, I entirely agree that it wouldn't make that much difference. The outlook for U.S. Treasury securities is pretty bad if you look at the number of securities that already exist and how many more would be issued, and then you consider that because of inflation, they have to pay higher interest rates. So the cost of servicing the debt is going up. If you go back to some previous time period when interest rates were much lower, it didn't really matter what was the total amount of the debt because the cost of servicing it was so low. But this is now getting to be a serious amount of the budget. And the budget is not going up. That is to say, the willingness to raise taxes is really not there. Instead, the Congress seemed to be much more focused on social issues or fighting among themselves or showing who can be more in compliance with the promises they made to their constituents who might want to go back to the gold standard or some pre-existing monetary system.
Well, William, with the debt being over $32 trillion now, one, I want to talk about exactly what that means. And two, does that play any role in this downgrading?
It may have played a role in a sense of being an excuse, but no. I mean, as a percentage of GDP and such, nothing fundamental changed before or after that rating. Again, this has been done before in the United States. It had no effect on U.S. bond rates. And I think, you know, other than the first day fluctuation, it's probably going to have no meaningful effect. The second rating issue is very different. The downgrading of the banks is the thing that folks need to be focusing on. That's the one that is interesting because the credit rating agencies are notorious for overrating banks. In other words, in the great lead up to the great financial crisis, they consistently gave AAA ratings to really trash derivatives that weren't even, shouldn't even been like D minus rated, and they were all AAA. So when the credit rating agencies turn on the banks in the United States, that's a real interesting story and suggests that should where our focus should be.
Well, what does it mean in your perspective with this and focusing on the banks like this?
Okay, so with the caveat that the credit rating agencies are terrible and have frequently been wrong, what they certainly are saying is, look, the thing about the recent banking failures in the United States, which those were very large institutions that failed, you know, probably among the 70 biggest in the world type of thing, is that it happened in relatively benign economic circumstances, right? So,
and very quickly, very quickly.
And very quickly, that's correct. So the rating agencies are, as always, way behind the curve, as are the regulators. So these problems have been built, allowed to build up for 2.5+ years with no meaningful regulatory action, even though the nature of the interest rate and liquidity risks they were taking simultaneously, they, the top bankers, was insane, right? It had no upside from the standpoint of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, an immense possible downside, and the regulators still didn't act, and the credit rating agencies still didn't act.
Well, John,
I really agree that the credit rating agencies, go ahead, please.
No, go ahead, you're making a comment.
The credit rating agencies generally have been behind the reality, and partly that's because of pressure on them. They were urged by their congressional representatives to delay any downgrade, et cetera. But I would go to a deeper problem, which is the middle tier of banks, not the bulge bracket, not the mega banks, not the ones with $3 or $4 trillion of assets. Those are much more closely regulated. But the size of Silicon Valley, that was a big outfit, but it was regulated as a regional, kind of a super regional, but it was also excessively concentrated in accounts for the high tech sector and initial public offerings, and venture capital. So if they had gone down, they would have closed down at least temporarily a lot of high tech companies at a time when the U.S. is very concerned about competing in high tech. But it's really a design defect that the classic commercial bank is too vulnerable. I'm not urging anybody to do this. I'm just saying that everybody who studies this realizes you can bring down a bank quite easily by selling short some of the shares and then starting a rumor. Of course, this is completely illegal, and if they catch you, you'll go to jail for a long time. But there are people that would try that risk. And so then what happened in the case of Silicon Valley Bank was they had an enormous withdrawal of deposits by wire transfer, not by going into a branch and saying, I want my money, and slapping your passbook on the counter and saying, I got to have my money. No, it wasn't. It was the total amount that they had on deposit went down so quickly that they couldn't replace it in the secondary market. And then the FDIC needed to reach down and find a regulation that had been passed, which allowed them to put into effect an emergency fund. Otherwise, it would have been a whole lot worse.
Well, why do you think it? Because, John, you said all of this happened, and it happened very quickly. I mean, why aren't the banks better regulated? Why, then, would this be allowed, obviously?
They have been better regulated, but it's a very, very difficult question as to how tightly to constrain them on their actions, especially if somebody is determined to give them much more free hand. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, there's an important role in any big bank, a risk manager, and the position was vacant for a year. Now, I don't mean to say that they had somebody in it who didn't know what they were doing. I mean, they didn't have anybody in it at all. That's like saying I'm running a museum and I don't have a security system, and I laid off the night watchman. I'm leaving the back door open, or not leaving the back door open, but leaving it to the point where anybody could break in and take whatever they want. It wasn't quite that bad, but it was really quite glaring, and it became obvious after the fact. And there's a number of others that are similarly structurally defectively set up, and too many large deposits that could be withdrawn very quickly. And the idea of the FDIC was to protect small depositors, which was needed during the Great Depression, which was almost 100 years ago. So we have bank regulation where the biggest changes were made 100 years ago, and the ones made since then have been not so effective in terms of adding stability to the system. And that's likely to get worse.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, likely to get worse. Well, William, what about this? I mean, the U.S. went through this major crisis with the banks back in 2007, 2008. I mean, was nothing learned from that, or what's the difference? Where do we stand now?
Well, yes, let me elaborate on what William said. William was referring to the packages of mortgage-backed securities, mm-hmm. which had the seal of major houses like Goldman Sachs and famously Lehman Brothers. But the individual mortgages which were packaged together, the idea was take a bunch of low-rated mortgages and somehow make those into high-rated bonds. Well, they tried to do that in 1500. It was called alchemy, turning lead into gold, et cetera. You can't really do it. And there was not enough regulation at all at that time, because those were not deposits. Those were not, specifically, they were not assets of the bank. The bank would buy mortgages and then transfer them to a created entity, and they were the mortgages were assets of the created entity, and the bonds were liabilities of the created entity, and the created entity was insufficiently capitalized, and so a lot of those came down.
Okay. William, did you want to comment on it? Go ahead.
Sure. So if you use the firing the watchman metaphor, the obvious question is, well, why did they fire the, get rid of, you know, not replace the night watchman?
Save an expensive paycheck, maybe? That's not why they did it.
And that's why they learned a number of lessons from the great financial crisis, supposedly. They didn't learn the most important lessons, and their response was actually contradictory on a theoretical basis. In particular, what they didn't learn was how perverse modern executive compensation is in terms of creating incentives. So, for example, let me get a little bit into the weeds, all right? These institutions that we've been talking about, the big ones, who are not the super big ones, but they're, you know, in the $120 billion range, which, by the way, get us back on another time to tell you about the politics of that. That was defined as a small institution to get a gutting of some of the federal legislation that responded to the great financial crisis. Okay. Anyhow, interest rate risk. This is what normal human beings don't understand. When interest rates go up, that's very bad if you own a fixed rate bond.
Right.
Particularly long-term ones. They're not supposed to buy long-term ones, but they bought long-term ones to get the slightly extra yield, and that really cost them. If they had bought short-term bonds, maybe they wouldn't have crashed. But
of course, they're not going to buy short-term bonds because when, as usual, longer terms have a higher interest rate, you get more yield by having the longer term bond, which has much more interest rate risk. So these places,
and the executive gets a bigger bonus.
That's my point. That's why you do it. Now, Silicon Valley, for example, hedged. And I won't go through the details, but they use what's called an interest rate swap. And all you need to know is that as your portfolio of regular assets loses market value, the hedge goes up in value. But of course, they then had a lot of inflation. And for at least modern times in the United States, which has not had significant inflation for 40 plus years. And as a result, the hedge went up a lot in value. Now, you don't want to recognize the loss on your portfolio of regular assets. So what they did is sell the hedge.
This is where they needed a risk manager. It was an inexplicable rookie mistake.
It just seems to be a lot of, to put it in very simplistic terms, a lot of lack of honesty involved in this whole industry and the poor people who are stuck in the middle. But let me just, because we're getting close to the end of time, I want to get back to a couple of other things. When we were talking earlier about the $32 trillion in debt of the United States, I want to talk about, because one of the reasons that the United States has been able to get away with this is basically because it prints the global reserve currency, the dollar itself. So it has definitely had a lot of leeway in dealing with this debt. As the situation seems to be changing, as it appears we're going from this unipolar to a multipolar world, John, this question is for you. I want to know about the significance in the de-dollarization process in all of this, as far as affecting the U.S. economy in general.
Well, there's always been attempts to diminish the importance of the dollar, starting in the 1980s when the yen was going to take over the role that the dollar enjoyed from the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944 onward. But the Japanese did not want that role. The Chinese central bank could have had it, but they did not want to. They did not want to have free trading of the yuan. They wanted to have exchange control to manage the exchange rate, which is certainly what I would have done if I had been running that central bank. But that was an intentional decision on their part not to take the opportunity, which is there. Now you have several large, what used to be called BRIC countries, Brazil, India, and South Africa, and a few others, trying to create an alternative to the dollar. And I hope they succeed, but I doubt it, because what people really seem to want are U.S. dollars. So when we look at the size of the dollar bonds, the aggregate amount of dollar bonds, we have to consider the dollar is not just the currency of the United States. The dollar is the currency that is widely used around the world. And a lot of individuals, a lot of businesses routinely keep dollars, and a lot of central banks keep dollars. And when that diminishes, then the bonds would look even more onerous than they currently do. The big reason why the bonds look so onerous now is the cost of carrying that amount of debt. When you're borrowing money at 1%, it looks a lot different than when you're borrowing it at 5%. And that's really hurting, because the U.S. Congress right now has no desire to raise taxes.
William, your prognosis, looking at the overall economic situation in the U.S. right now?
Compared to other industrial nations, the United States is actually at the lead, not the trail in all of this. Japan, if you're worried about GDP to debt ratios, Japan is vastly higher than the United States. So no, it isn't the dollarization that means that if you have a sovereign currency and you let rates float with the market and you borrow only in your currency, you're not in default scenarios. And the United States isn't going to default on the debt, no matter what the regulatory agencies say. It is possible that the Republicans are now so crazy that they would cause a default briefly through the debt ceiling, but the resultant economic disaster would probably also sweep Democrats into control of the House and the Senate fairly quickly as well. So,
I entirely agree. I could not believe that.
John, go ahead. 30 seconds. Go ahead. Go ahead. Final comments.
I really couldn't believe they came so close to defaulting on the debt. It's like too many people, particularly the outliers in the party in control of the House of Representatives, really seem to want to default on the debt of the United States, not seeming to realize how much difference that would make. For example, their own checking accounts wouldn't work. Their ATM cards wouldn't work. They'd have to go into their backyard and dig up those silver coins that they have in a box in their backyard. That's not how we want to run the
Okay. On that note, so sorry, we're out of time. We're out of time. I appreciate talking to both of you. William Black, white-collar criminologist, professor of economics and law, University of Missouri, Kansas City, author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One out of Kansas City, and John Edmonds, professor of finance, Babson College.